For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Okay. So thank you all very much for sitting together on the ground and in the cloud, coming together to continue the endless, beginningless thread of our ancient ancestral way, way of the Bodhisattva. This is what we do in our lives in Sesshin, but always really, is continue this teaching and embodiment of the Bodhisattva way, weaving this ancient brocade of practice, lineage, stories, lives, birth and death. So in Sesshin, in Zazen, every breath, every step, every activity of mind, heart, is this kind of weaving of an ancient dragon practice body, a little like piece of the brocade, you could say, of this ancient way. And of course, you know, wonderful science tells us that we're all woven into this giant fabric of life, maybe of all being, past, present, and future. But today, I wanted to start off by focusing on this teaching brocade sewn and offered by the life of a great Zen ancestor named Charlotte Choko Beck. So, how many people have heard of Choko, read Choko, like Choko, hate Choko? So, such an unusual teacher, maybe beyond our time in some ways. And Choko, if you've read anything she's written or listened to anything about her, was very enthusiastic about intensive Sesshin practice, intensive Zazen, thoroughgoing, complete practice. She was like, you can't get away with anything without Choko. So I think it's really fitting to open her teaching for this practice commitment period and for Sesshin this morning. You know, this morning we begin, many of us, 8 weeks of intensive community practice. This traditional Buddhist practice period is known as Ango, peaceful abiding, or Kese Ango. It's a term that is used in Japan, which kind of means this peaceful abiding within restraint, within some rules, within this kind of schedule that we agree to. Peaceful within restraint. Even that word of being constrained or having some rules to follow, like a schedule, you know, here for this practice commitment period, we devise our own schedules, basically, of Zazen, of study, of community service and practice. But even though you design your own schedule, you know, at some point you're going to be like, do I really have to do that? Maybe I, you know, don't have to really, I committed to this, but, and it's fine to revise and resubmit, you know, but it's always interesting to see what happens when there's just a little bit of not always having everything the way I want in every single moment. This is Joko's toughness. So Joko was born in 1917. Imagine that. What's going on? Like, was there still like World War I going on in 1917 still? And this soon followed by a depression. And then another world war, you know, and a woman in this time. And she lived in both the 20th and 21st century. She died in, I think, 2011, in her 90s. She's a mother of four children. You know, this is a tough practice if you have no kids. But she raised four children. She's a grandmother. And then she came to practice in middle age, in her 40s. You know, I think she still had a younger daughter, at least. But think about that. You know, like some people are like, 40s, it's too late. Never going to get enlightened or, you know, whatnot. And somehow Joko seemed to be one of these sort of astronauts, psychonauts, you know, spiritual seekers, who even before was really trying to explore, I would say probably find something that she knew already. And she studied with some kind of famous early Japanese teachers who were teaching Americans even before Suzuki Roshi arrived. No, Suzuki Roshi arrived in 1959. She received Dharma transmission from this very famous teacher, Maitsumi Roshi. I don't know how many people have heard of Maitsumi. Some of us, especially older folks, Dale. And, you know, so Maitsumi and the people around him founded Zen Center of Los Angeles. And Joko was a big kind of person in that initial time. She lived in San Diego, but come up to LA, eventually lived there. And I don't know if it's in the documentary that I shared with some people in the practice commitment period, but she said something like, you know, she left Zen Center of Los Angeles and she really started her own way in about 1983. And she said, you know, I left because I didn't think that these people who were practicing Zen were very nice to each other. Mm-hmm. And thought there might not be something quite right going on. And went her own way, kind of radically so. Formed her own group, in a little house in San Diego eventually, and taught there. And later in May, one of our Sangha members, Brian Taylor, who now lives in New Mexico, will be here in town, and he actually practiced with Joko. I never got into any of her sesshins. Always wanted to get into a sesshin, and I was never, nobody answered my emails. I actually, when I was preparing for this, I even have the phone number and address trying to figure out, you know, how to get into that situation. And somehow I just ended up going to San Francisco Zen Center again and again, as well as a few other places. But they had full sesshins. Joko's name means pure light. Beautiful name. And there's a kind of purity to the intensity of her practice. She has a lineage that exists to this day. Pretty small. Because, you know, when you reject your teacher and you kind of even reject this whole lineage and do your own thing, that's dangerous business because you don't have the weight of all this history and tradition that you kind of are clinging to, like I am, in Soto Zen, you could say. But here's a description. The ordinary mind Zen school is evolving a style of Zen that is adapted to Western temperaments and ways of life, but maintains the rigor and discipline of its traditional roots. The teaching is highly pragmatic. It is less concerned with the concentrated pursuit of special experiences than with the development of insight into the whole of life. It favors a slower, but healthier, that's a pretty bold statement, more responsible development of the whole character, in which psychological barriers and emotions are addressed rather than bypassed. It's a practice. It sees practice as working with whatever comes up in our everyday lives, including being in a relationship, family life, and the workplace, as well as formal and structured practice of Zen. Whoa. You know, most Zen doesn't talk about itself. But this is sort of the boldness of Joko to stand up in her experience. And also to take a somewhat self-reflective psychological approach, introspective approach, about what is actually going on in our modern body and minds. Her teaching is pretty devoid of these Japanese trappings. She gave up, she did wear them, but she gave up wearing formal robes. Although, I don't know, if you saw her in the street, whenever I see pictures of her, she looks like a monk to me. You know, you can take the robes out of the monk, but you can't take the monk out of clothing, you know. So she was unique. I don't know. I think I heard in her Zendo they just had like a rock on an altar or something, not even a Buddha. You know, we have all these beautiful things here at Ancient Dragon that remind us of awakening, of our path, of the possibility of collective liberation, you might say. But there are many of them are grounded in an ancient culture that few of us know really anything about. And I won't say all of us, because there are some in here who know quite a bit about Japan, China, or even India. But generally speaking, you know, we're convert Buddhists or Americans picking up this tradition. So Joko used very little Zen speak, you know, didn't have to learn all these unfamiliar words. She's just kind of straightforward. And she's very wary of people getting hung up on enlightenment, because she doesn't come from our kind of Suzuki Roshi Soto Zen tradition. She comes from some other tradition that kind of blended Soto Zen with Rinzai-ish koan practice, you know, where you Zazen is reflecting on these teaching stories and you're endeavoring for enlightenment. If anybody's ever tried that, like, I'm going to sit down and get enlightened today. You know, I have. You know, you sit enough sashins and you're like, I'm going for it, you know. Mm-hmm. And while you're playing in the entrance way, it's not bad. It's good to try for it sometimes. But, you know, when that's what it's all about, who's got a little more enlightenment than the next person, which I think might be happening in some of these places. I passed a few more koans. I've never passed one, as far as I can tell. And she also thought that students, especially us bright, you know, Americans, with voracious appetites for learning, can easily mistake study and talking about the Dharma for the actual true dragon, for the true Dharma. I've read all this. I've read the Pali Canon. I've read all of Dogen. not bad. Very nice things to read. But how is sitting going on your cushion? How are you meeting each person? So we'll put some pressure on each other, like we're going to have a meal served to us. How do we respond to that situation, to people offering things to us and to receiving this gift? What's going on percolating in our bodies and minds around that? That's not the food I want. I want more of that. That server didn't do this. That person sitting didn't offer me their bowl in the right way. Or isn't that beautiful the way they did? You know, our minds are constantly doing this kind of thing. And Joko knew this. And her teaching, I would say, is, you know, this exploration of how we're stuck in some kind of self-centered dream. Now, who wants to hear that? You're self-centered. I remember my teacher saying to me, oh, you're finally seeing how selfish you are. And I just cried and said, thank you. May I continue to explore that the rest of my life. And this was a very gentle teacher. Joko probably would have been a little harder on me. But she is really like an American expression of Four Noble Truth practice. And Paula, you like the Four Noble Truths, so you want to recite them for us?
Life is suffering. Desire is the cause of all suffering. A way exists to eliminate suffering. The Eightfold Path is the way.
Mm-hmm. So, suffering. How does it arise? And how does it not be in the way of us caring for the world? How does that work? And she was very interested in us understanding how suffering arises in our own bodies and minds and how to move away from that. And she labels two types of thinking. One, she says, is technical or practical thinking, which are, you know, how am I going to cook this meal? Maybe our tenso is doing that. She goes, there's nothing wrong with thinking in the sense of what I call technical thinking. We have to think in order to walk from here to the corner or to bake a cake or to solve a physics problem. That use of the mind is fine. It isn't real or unreal. It's just what is. But opinions, judgments, memories, dreaming about the future, 90% of thoughts spinning around in our heads have no essential reality, and we go from birth to death unless we wake up, wasting most of our life with them. I want the best deal on this product on Amazon, you know. Then I'm really going to be cool. The gruesome part, imagine this, she calls the gruesome part of sitting. And it is gruesome, believe me, quoting her, is to begin to see what's really going on in our mind. It's a shocker for all of us. We see that we are violent, prejudiced, and selfish. We are all those things because a conditioned life based on false thinking leads to these states. Human beings are basically good, kind, and compassionate. But it takes hard digging to uncover that buried jewel. So, if your zazen's a little difficult, if you're struggling a bit, you're in great company. And she thinks of some of the tedious repetition of sitting daily or relentlessly in sesshin, like learning to play notes and really learning to listen to them. I think she says, you know, she was a pianist. Her teacher said, play these three notes over and over and over and over and over and over again. She's like, you know, I'm in a conservatory. I already know how to play these notes, right? But somehow she learned sewing practice is like this. People are like, why don't my stitches look like yours, Hogetsu? what's wrong? You're not teaching me right. Why don't my notes sound like, you know, some great pianist? So this sitting we do is developing these eyes and ears and hands and breath of practice more and more. Joko says, let's look at the sitting process itself. You know, in Soto Zen, in our school, you know, there's a lot of talk and study, and it's such a wonderful school. But in some ways, there's a kind of cultural thing of not revealing too much. So Joko is like, oh, let's look at the process here. What we need to do is be aware of what's happening right now. You don't have to believe me, but you can experiment for yourself. When I'm drifting away from the present, what I do is listen to the traffic. I make sure there's nothing I miss. Nothing. I just really listen. That's as good as a koan or these teaching stories, because it's happening at this very moment. So as Zen students, you have a job to do, a very important job. Bring your life out of dreamland and into the real immense reality that is. Now, I just want to say something about listening to traffic. Like, try listening to all the traffic. Like, we'll be like, I like a bird sound, but oh, that other thing, I'm going to try to like close my ear to it. You know. But really listen. Somebody talked about, I think Pauline Oliveros was it, Deep Listening, where everything is a song. But Joko says, this job isn't easy. It takes courage. Only people with tremendous guts can do this practice for more than a short period of time. So this is her encouragement. But we don't do it just for ourselves. Perhaps we do it first. This is true, right? Like at first we might be like, I want to get rid of suffering. I want to feel better. Nothing wrong with that. But as our life gets grounded and gets real and gets basic, she uses this term over and over again, basic. You know, that's usually some disrespectful term, right? They're so basic. But, you know, we get to the ground. She says, other people immediately sense it. And then we begin to influence things around us in a kind way. In this book, Nothing Special, she even starts with the Suzuki Roshi quote. So she didn't give up completely on Japanese teachers, but she begins with, Zen is not some fancy special art of living. Our teaching is just to live, always in reality, in its exact sense. What is reality exactly? What is this exact sense? This is our why we're sitting here in Zashin, to touch that a little. And in this book, Nothing Special, which is like coffee stains on it and it's yellowed. Sorry, Joko. She outlines some stages in practice, some loose stages. Again, not a common thing in Soto Zen to be like there's any stage in practice. But I think it's helpful just to consider, what am I doing? Because, you know, a lot of times you're like facing the cushion. All I have to do is face them all. Kind of feel upright and good about myself. Well, that's true in some ways. But what do you hear? Joko's take. So you could say stage zero. She calls it pre-path. You know, there's these stages of change by what? Prochaska and DiClemente in psychology that's like, you know, somebody's ready for change, but somebody like they're not ready, right? Pre-contemplative or something like that. I don't even remember it from, yeah, thanks. It's been a while since I've coursed in that dharma as a clinical psychologist. But she says, stage zero is pre-path. This is what I call the clueless stage, okay? She goes, you're stuck in self-centered dream, totally caught in reactivity, right? And automatically you're grasping for comfort, pushing away things that don't feel good, you know, that don't fit our agenda. I thought it was going to be this way. No. And so in this clueless stage, I feel like this is hell. But when you're in it, it's not hell. It feels great. It's like any kind of like addiction will tell you this, you know, obsessed with possessions, power, and self-promotion. You know, when you're in those states, you'd like, this is awesome. Until it's not. But we can feel like pre-path is heaven or Disneyland. The only problem is we have to wait a little longer to get what we want at Disneyland unless we bought the expensive tickets, you know. I mean, think about this. Like, here's a pre-path state. What could be wrong with making Canada the 51st state? I think I'll have a business making weapons. Isn't that cool? And then I'll have more money and a gold-plated toilet and a Tesla or something. You know, like these are all in some ways encouraged in our culture. And nothing wrong with people feeling and thinking that way, because that's probably the normal way to approach things in this world. So Joko says this pre-path living, being caught in our emotions and taking them out on others, thinking that others are to blame for our troubles, or if we just get the right thing, all our troubles go away. I'll add that piece to it. That's the pre-path part. And then she's called stage one, self-awareness. She calls this a beginning to recognize what's going on and the harm that it does. Becoming aware of our constant internal reactions of judging, evaluating, dualizing, categorizing, agitated. And at this stage, she actually recommends labeling thoughts and feelings, which is a practice done in some other traditions pretty commonly. And I don't say you have to do this, but it's very interesting to just watch like some thought arise and instead of get involved in it, just to be like, oh, that's anger arising. It's very different. Yeah, that's greed arising. That's jealousy arising. That's, you know, fantasy happening. But at this stage, she does recommend labeling. This is the first stage. And Joko's like, yeah, this might last for 10 or 15 years. What? You know? But indeed, the more I practice, the less, like, the more I feel I need to practice more. Truthfully. And, you know, this kind of experience, she says, you know, when we start to look at ourselves, real self-awareness, not so much self-involvement, there's like a major shock. And I would say this is something called samvega, which is like, whoa, when you really see the consequences of your out of controlness, you are motivated to sit. Like, all of you are coming here when you could do so many other things. So something's motivating you. That has to be pretty serious. And then at this point, our way-seeking mind is presented with a choice. Do I want to continue and work towards awakening? Or do I want to get back into that suffering pre-path pool? We do have that choice. And Joko says, you know, the battleground of struggle from stage one to stage two, which I'll tell you about, we begin to realize we have a choice. And one is to refuse to practice. I'm not going to label these thoughts. This is boring. I'm just going to sit here and dream about something pleasant. You can watch in the Zendo. There'll be people who are like, You can see like they're sitting like this, right? Or they're like, Now, sometimes people can fake you out and they're just really in zazen, but their body's just sleeping. But this choice to dream is very different than a kind of posture, and you see it in your zazen, how your mudra is, how your body is, your chin is tucked just slightly, your face is different, your eyes aren't grabbing things. It's very different. So you can notice that. Of course, nobody here does these things, but I've seen this at other sex. So the choice is to stay stuck and continue to suffer or practice. It's like suffering or practice, when practice sometimes feels like uncomfortable, but it's not necessarily suffering. And she says from stage two on, compassion and appreciation begin to grow. So we're not even near that compassion stage yet, according to Joko, when we start to become aware. But she says, stage two, in this stage, we've become familiar with our habits of body, speech, and mind, and we start to see this emotion-thought complex that arises in response to fear, discomfort, and insecurity. And this is tough. It's not for everyone. You know, if you have certain experiences, this plunging too deeply into this pain might be difficult. Might not be even recommended, I would say. But she says that in this stage too, we're motivated to break down the emotional reactions. We interrupt, I would say, clinging to these narratives we have, justifying our reactions, why we're better and they're worse, or I'm worse and everybody else is better. That's another variation on that theme. We interrupt this clinging to narrative and justification and start to learn how not to act out internally or externally against ourselves or others. And she says, well, this might begin 2 to 5 years into practice. What? You know, like she's really giving a realistic view of practice, but it's one that I remember reading this going, that long? You know? She says, as we move increasingly into the second stage, there begins to be more and more periods where we find ourselves saying, well, that's okay. I didn't even know why I thought that was such a problem. Do you have that experience? Like, you know, somebody cuts you off in traffic and you're all upset. And then you're like, what was that? You know, I'm still alive. So are they. So I could go into some more advanced stages from Joko, but I think 1 and 2 are pretty good for us. I'll just say that in 3, there she outlined 6, but in stage 3, she says you encounter some moments of pure experiencing without self-centered thought, just experience, just this kind of samadhi of thusness. She said in some Zen places, they call this enlightenment. And then, you know, so you get little glimpses of that and they become a little more and more. It's not like you don't think, but your thinking has a very different quality. And your experience has a lighter, more open, flexible quality. You know, the end stage, number 6, is like complete Buddhahood. So, you know, like sometimes I think when we give the precepts, we say, you know, are you willing to upkeep these precepts all the way until Buddhahood or beyond Buddhahood? Something like that, I think, is in that ceremony. So in some ways, she's recommending, go all the way, bodhisattvas. Don't stop, but it's long. It's a long haul. Even though There's not supposed to be any stages in Zen or any sudden or gradual, you know, but still, I think Joko has some wisdom for us. And, you know, she has this little verse that her groups recite. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Just this moment without anything extra. So like, when you serve, can you be just this moment in the Zendo without anything extra? When you ring the bell, when you get up and fold your cushion, you're like, oh, there's so many people in the Zendo, I have to fold my cushion every time I get up, you know. Just fold the cushion. And I feel this really resonates with Suzuki's teaching of Zen is not some fancy special part of living. Our way is just to live always in reality, in this reality that is beyond our comprehension in some true way. But still, that reality means that all this self-centered dream is just a dream, and that our true self, the way things really are, is really quite wonderful, amazing, and the true basis for caring, for responsive activity. And in this time and place, you know, living in reality is a very good thing to do, I think. So I want to give us a little time to chat. And I know the kitchen, it's 11 o'clock. The kitchen might need to leave. So thank you for hanging in there. Joko is the study of a lifetime, but maybe we could have any comments or questions or anything else people might want to see. Douglas is leaving. Are the servers leaving too? Paul's leaving.
The servers in delivery right now?
I don't know. I think it's just the kitchen crew and the servers come later. Is that right? Now? Okay. Servers, thank you very much, everyone, for preparing our meal. Is that everyone?
Should I keep recording?
I think our questions can be recorded. I think they usually are. Thanks. So, back there in the corner, Nicholas.
Yeah, there's so much to respond to, but I kept thinking about the play Angels in America.
Mm.
And, you know, when the angel crashes through the ceiling and the angel's screaming, I. And when I first saw it years ago, I was like, what is going on? Like, what does that mean? And what it means, it's a poetic expression of our self-centeredness, you know. And, you know, I love Joko's teaching, and she was such a huge part of my early meditation practice, you know, just through her books and talks. And I love that she's sort of a renegade in Zen, and I think that you started out with what her community now says, that we want to be a healthier, it sounded a little grandiose, but
yeah.
It's very apt, because Zen has been quite toxic. There have been a lot of, you know, harm, toxic teachers, and because of this issue of spiritual bypass,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Joko was about embracing the shadow, digging down into your material and facing it, mm-hmm. not skating above it and thinking you're enlightened and that you're above the rules. She was very much about consequences and that you are part of this world and you too are subject to karma.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And this emphasis on being very thorough in this regard, because these teachers that have been so great can spin out so easily with a lot of help from their communities usually. But so everybody's involved, but it's not just sitting in a monastery, but it's showing up all continually to your life and taking responsibility. Sometimes it's just like, oh, thank you. Thank you for pointing this out. Or, I'm sorry, I just had a difficult time receiving what you offered me. Can we try it again? You know. Jerry Bodhisattva.
I liked your comment on the stages she goes through. And in one sense, I can see how they're stages. But when you were going through them, I thought, oh, I've been in zero recently. And I don't know if it's so much linear, but it circles around. And some days you are precursive, and other days, you know, you're in a different place. But it's a nice way to think about your practice. It's another way to have a little indicator about how is my practice coming along and where am I. And
Yeah, and you've talked quite a bit about indicators of your practice. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you pay attention to how you pay attention and what you're paying attention to? Wait, Bodhisattva.
Could you say a bit more about maintaining bodhicitta? Like maintaining this way-seeking mind?
Well, you have to take care of it like a newborn. You know, very attentive. And you can't really know it completely, but giving it space to grow and develop. And indeed, sometimes I worry about even talking about Joko because it can seem somewhat disencouraging, you know, somewhat deflating, like, let me just throw my bodhicitta out the window. But truthfully, the more you practice, the stronger it becomes. Is that what you wanted to address, or was there something in particular?
It seemed like what she was talking about, especially that pivot from stage one to stage two, and the rosy-colored glasses about stage zero, which can feel good, and practice can feel like suffering.
Yeah.
And I personally have found that difficult.
Yeah.
Often. So I was just looking for additional encouragement.
Yeah, keep doing it. Or go back. Go back to delusion. Like, give yourself fully to pre-path. See how that is now. It's a bummer. You know, it's really hard to go back after a while. You can visit it, but it's like, oh, that was, you know. So when it was all I wanted. If you live long enough, you feel that way about quite a few things. But in practice, in particular, there is that. So it's hard. And Joko says, this is hard. Constantly, the sirens are calling us to the rocks. We're like, let's take the ship in that direction, you know. And so this is a difficult practice, and to know that, but also you seek good friends. This is why we do this in community and with the teacher and in a variety of ways, that there's a lot of support for waking up as well. You're still here for now.
For now.
Howard Bodhisattva.
Sort of building on this. Not Joko, not Zen, but some of you know that I have a sort of part of me that really likes the Pure Land tradition. They have this idea called Bombu, which is a fool. And like, it's really owning, really sitting with the fact that you are a fool. You are full of desire. You are like going everywhere this way or that. It's so easily, you are a fool and you're easily fooled. You're like really sitting with that. Owning that is part of the process, right? As you were talking, you were mentioning like very clear examples, like, you know, we're about to have do formal meals, which I'm not going to be here for, but I'm not going to. This person is in the room, but I don't want to like spotlight them.
Yeah.
But it was really funny because for years, during sessions, I would serve. I just like served all the time. Like, why am I serving all the damn time? There's this one person who did the gestures differently, and I was like, and it used to piss me off so much. Like, every time I took, like, what the fuck is this? Why are you doing this that way? I know what you mean. And over time, over years, it's suddenly become, I kind of look for it, and I kind of love it. I still think it's incorrect, but like, and I enjoy seeing this gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And because nobody else does it.
Yeah.
I know what they mean anyway.
And that's right, you knew. So then you became intimate.
But for years, I was so pissed off.
Yeah. Well, there's a famous comment, right, to a teaching story. Master, why is it that intimacy feels like enmity? Because it goes away, you know, whenever you live with someone, you get married, you live with someone, everything's great, and then all of a sudden, you find yourself hating them. Why the hell am I with this person? You know, because they fart at night or something like that, you know, but or they gesture in ways we're not comfortable with, and then, you know, you get obsessed with that, but then all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's so beautiful, now I miss that snoring, you know, or I miss, because that's we get to know each other. Even if we do our gassho the same, that's what's beautiful about the forms, is everybody does do it a little bit differently, and that's how we know each other. That's a great example, Howard. Thank you.
Dennis Moran has...
Dennis. Hello.
Thank you very much for your talk this morning. I have a question. I'm aware of myself, is that... My self-centeredness gets more subtle with time and practice. Mm-hmm. And is it fair to say that it's infinite?
Joko would say there's stage six is possible, but she kind of said like for nobody. But it is infinite to some extent. And there is also an end. And
okay. So will we ever know that?
Maybe not.
Okay.
Those who are greatly enlightened about their delusion are Buddhas. Buddhas will not necessarily know that they are Buddhas.
Okay.
So in some ways, this is the realm of faith in practice. But knowing, starting to see the subtlety is really great. You know, I'm always so happy about it because... these things that go underground, if we don't pay attention to them, they'll be like cicadas, you know. They will grow up and come out and be kind of devastating and noisy and ugly. But thank you, Dennis. And you know, the subtlety is, I think this is why Joko says, oh, this might take 10 years, 15 years. It will still cycle through it. It gets more and more subtle, but also we can liberate it. And we do that with the help of other people annoying us or making us feel great. Nicholas?
Yeah, I think there's, for me, there's a lot of solidity in thinking that my thoughts mean something.
Mm-hmm.
And with practice, you know, I constantly remind myself that they don't. My thoughts don't mean anything except practical thinking, mm-hmm. like she's talking about. And that is very uplifting. And there's a lightness. And I can,
mm-hmm.
like all my judgments, I can realize that, oh, yeah, but my thoughts don't mean anything. You know, it's like, I don't have to be right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing about it's connected to being, you know, thinking that I know something.
Mm-hmm. Then you'll really know something. And can share it with the world, which you do. Leo.
Thank you for the talk. Talking about stage zero or the pre-contemplative.
Yeah, pre-bath.
Yeah, I'm also thinking, like, pre-bath, yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
How, like, stage zero is so important. And I have a hunch that most of us here, it's because we've come really in contact with
yeah.
This. Yes. And also, I mean, I think last week we were talking about, like, embracing the demon or inner demons, etc. And how, like, I feel that I'm becoming more in peace with my pre-path, and I also acknowledge when it shows up. And also today, I've been kind of like finding myself and labeling my own thinking, because I was like, it's the second zazen, and I should be this way, and I'm going in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And I was like, oh my God, this is driving me crazy. And at the same time, that is the practice, right? Just being able to observe this waving.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, it's like keep practicing.
Yeah.
Because that will deepen your practice and understanding. But to go back, I think the pre-path.
Yeah.
I think it's very important. It's almost like the gate to being here. It's for me.
That's right. That's right. So our deluded mind becomes precious, you could say. I don't remember this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I will, Paul. In the Buddhist, in Mahayana scriptures, there's often this like idea of that delusion is the awakened mind, or there's quotes around this there is a preciousness to this pre-path, but we don't even appreciate it when we're caught in it. But once you see it, it itself, you could say, is awakening. But I don't know if you have any choice. Quote Paul about that.
I mean, the most famous one, I guess, first shows up in Shantai commentaries and then spreads. It just says that the delusions, right, the klesha, are bodhi, are awakening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just exactly as you said, and then it gets, as these things do, it gets reversed. It's nothing other than.
Yeah, so this means this is this radical non-dualism, right? Everything's included. But how would you wake up if you weren't asleep? How would you? Anastasia?
I don't have an answer to that question, but the fool and the zero, I'm an Orient Tarot person, so the zero is the fool card, and unless you actually take that journey, step off the path, you don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So, and you have to, we have to start someplace.
Yeah.
And then we move forward, or not.
That's great. Yeah, that would be great in the Zendo to have a fool card, a tarot card, hanging up in here someplace, and then don't hold on to being a fool.
But it's so comforting.
Yes. You know, there's other parts of the path, as Joko would say. But that's great. That's right. Or Howard's, you're a fool. You're really a fool. Or sometimes in the Zen literature, an ass, which is like a donkey. What a wonderful practice we have, bodhisattvas. How could this be that we get to hear the wondrous Dharma and practice together with it? I think maybe it's time for us to do other things. And I just want to appreciate everyone's practice and May our foolishness continue. May our extension, may our attention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them.